So I would like to tell you a story from the suttas that has to do with a lot of interesting themes. It has to do with the theme of balance. How do you find balance? Which is a very interesting kind of contemporary issue for a lot of people. And also has to do with the theme or the idea of protection. How do we protect ourselves? How do we protect others? Protection is a kind of a shorthand for many other things, like how do we take care of each other? And ties into questions of altruism. How much do we sacrifice ourselves for the benefit of others? And how much do we take care of ourselves at the expense of others? Or whatever. The issue of protection is a very important one in the suttas in ancient India. Perhaps in in ancient times when the idea of being protected, now we have police, I suppose, who protect us, and society is relatively civil in our culture. But in many places in the world, and even places in our culture, the idea of how do you protect yourself is a very, very important one. And then people find all kinds of different ways to find self-protection and protection. So you find the Buddha talking a lot about how do you protect yourself? How do you get healthy protection? And one of the things he says repeatedly is that the practice of mindfulness is a practice of protection. It's a way of protecting yourself. Loving kindness, practice of love, is also a form of protection. It safeguards ourselves, a way of caring for ourselves. So this story is a story of two acrobats, an acrobat and an acrobat's assistant. And they go around in marketplaces and do their acrobatic tricks, and then I guess they have a hat or a bowl, and then people will throw their coins in, and that's how they make their living. So the acrobat, the master acrobat, tells the assistant, "Okay, let's climb up on that pole, or you climb up on the pole, or I'll climb up. We'll climb up on the pole, and you stand on my shoulders. And standing on my shoulders, while we're there doing our tricks, on top of my shoulders, you protect me in this balancing act, and I'll protect you." And in that way, we'll do our tricks, and people will be quite delighted, and we'll make lots of money. And the assistant says, "No, it's different. We certainly should climb up on that pole, and I'll get on your shoulders, but I'll protect myself up there, and you protect yourself. And by protecting our individual selves, we'll protect the other one. And that way, people will be delighted with our show and we'll make lots of money." So so the Buddha hears about this little story. And the Buddha says, "That's right. In that circumstance, in the circumstance that they're in, and they're being acrobats, the assistant is right, that it's better to protect oneself, find one's own balance, protect one's own balance. And if one protects one's own balance, then you're protecting the other person also." And I can imagine this works really well with acrobats, where the idea of balance, finding your balance, is something really you find for yourself. It's an internal kind of thing. Where's your balance? How do you find your own balance? How do you be balanced on a pole? Someone looking from outside maybe see you wobbling a little bit, but to really find the midpoint where you're really going to be balanced is an internal movement, something we feel inside of ourselves, and we find the center of gravity and things like that. And so the Buddha said, in that circumstance, that's right. And then the Buddha went on to say, basically kind of in translating this situation to people who practice, you do meditation practice, a spiritual practice, Buddhist practice. And he says, "I will protect myself if you're interested in protecting yourself, then you should establish the four foundations of mindfulness. Practice the four foundations of mindfulness, which is the practice of mindfulness that we do here. So if you want to protect yourself, then you pay attention to your body, which is the first foundation of mindfulness. You live in your body. You live through your body. You be careful with your body, not just simply in terms of getting enough exercise and eating good food, but you pay very careful attention to the movement within our body of our motivations, our impulses, our reactivity, our emotions. We pay attention to the balance within our own body. We pay attention to the feeling tone upon which so much else arises. We pay attention to our mental state. We pay attention to the dharmas, to the inner processes that come into play that either cloud the mind so we can't see properly or illuminate the mind so we can see properly. So we pay attention to these things. And in paying attention to these things, we find our inner balance. So here we're translating this idea of the acrobats to ourselves, which works very well, I think, because spiritual balance or deep inner balance for ourselves is something we have to take responsibility for ourselves. You can't expect someone else to find that balance for yourself. And so you have to find it in yourself. Unless, of course, you're so imbalanced and you don't know how to find it for yourself, that you only find the balance by leaning against someone else. You know, one way of getting a balance, of course, if you're always leaning like this, then if you find someone else that leans the opposite direction, then you're balanced. But it's not really a very stable balance, because if this person goes away, after all, we're doing death and dying this Friday, so the people go away, then you'll fall also. But if you have this balance here, if you find that inner balance where you're standing on your own two feet, very balanced in yourself, then you're not leaning against something which is inherently unstable. And only you can find that. And the Buddha is suggesting you find that through the practice of awareness, by bringing the awareness within you and paying attention to your body very deeply, to your feelings, your mental states, and these inner processes. Then the Buddha goes on and he says, I will protect others. If you want to protect others, then you should... So this is also interesting, right? So he's told you how to protect yourself. Now, if you're interested in protecting others, your family, your neighbors, your society, what should you do then? What do you think the answer then is? You practice the four foundations of mindfulness. and then he goes on to say, so you should establish mindfulness. Then he goes on to say this very famous little sentence. Protecting oneself, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself. That the two are very closely connected. They're so intertwined that they become the same thing. They can be the same thing if we understand how to do it in a healthy way. Before I go on to read what the Buddha says about that, I'd like to make some comments about the idea of altruism, taking care of other people. My impression, and I haven't really been a student of this particular theme in Western and Eastern society, but my impression is that it doesn't really matter so much if this is true in terms of East, in terms of India, in terms of Western culture or whatever, but I think the point can still be made. My impression is that there's a very important or powerful strand of thought in Western culture about the importance of being altruistic, sacrificing oneself for the well-being of others. We have in the Christian tradition, kind of a monastic, especially in the monastic, like St. Francis, and coming maybe from Jesus, the idea that you're the servant of other people. And this is such a high value that it translates, I think, at times, this idea that you're supposed to sacrifice yourself for the well-being of others. That's really all that's really is important, is helping other people. So the idea of being altruistic has a very high ideal in certain currents in Western thought. And when Westerners study Buddhism or read about Buddhism, learn about it, They often translate or interpret Buddhist teachings through that altruistic lens. And you find that often, Westerners who feel, I have to sort of sacrifice myself, myself for the center, for the teacher, for the whatever. Because somehow that's what's in their mind is kind of the whole point. One very common Buddhist teaching that's taken as being a teaching for altruism is from the Jataka tales of the former lifetimes of the Buddha, where he's reborn as an animal, for example, or in various ways, and he sacrifices himself for the well-being of some other animal, some other being. So, for example, he comes across the hungry lioness who's starving, maybe has cubs, and, you know, maybe about to starve to death. And so he cuts off parts of his own flesh, or he offers his own life, lets himself be killed, so this lioness can eat. And it sounds to us very altruistic. And that's how we read and interpret that kind of idea. I don't know much about Indian culture. But I've read scholars of Indian culture who have said that the idea of altruism, as it's understood in the West, is a foreign idea in India. The idea that you would sacrifice your own welfare for the welfare of others is somewhat of a foreign idea in that culture. I mean, sure, there's times that it happens. But it isn't that people are meant to be selfish either. But rather that the idea that one's own welfare and the welfares of others is completely intermixed, completely connected, inseparably connected from each other. So that someone who pursues spiritual practice, like the Buddha, to perfection, is not being selfish, but that is bringing benefit to the people around them, to the society and to the world. I haven't heard it in recent years, but I used to hear a lot. People would say, oh, my family, my friends are complaining to me or criticizing me because I meditate that I'm being selfish. It's a self-indulgent practice. You're kind of sitting with your eyes closed and you're just kind of focusing in on yourself. And that must be a very selfish thing to do. Has anybody told any of you that? No? Some people, yes? Now, if you spend exactly the same amount of time collecting stamps or watching television, you probably wouldn't have been criticized the same way. But somehow, with that part of our psyche, which is that part of our human behavior, which has to do with spirituality, if you do something which seemingly is kind of internal, you might get criticized for being self-indulgent. Because I believe this, at times, a very strong Western emphasis on spirituality involves being of service. The social gospel in Western spirituality that came out of the late 1900s, which is very, very important for our Western psyche. But is it self-indulgent? It can be self-indulgent to do a meditation practice by oneself. And I certainly know, as a teacher, I certainly have recognized that in people on retreats and stuff. Occasionally I meet people who it seems that their whole spiritual thrust of is narcissistic. You know, it's very self-indulgent. But it's sometimes very hard to see that because there is a kind of internal focus when you do meditation practice. It's not automatically narcissistic. So you can't always see it. And sometimes it takes, you know, a few years of knowing someone and saying, well, this looks a little bit off. So it can happen that way. But the great majority, I don't think that's the case. So the in this line of thinking, there's a very powerful verse in the Dhammapada, in the verses of the Buddha, that I think is upsetting, perhaps, to Westerners when they initially hear it. The line goes like this. Don't sacrifice your own welfare for the welfare of others, no matter how great. Don't sacrifice your own welfare for others, no matter how great the other's welfare might be. So initially, that might sound like a very selfish thing to say. But I don't think at all the Buddha is implying you shouldn't be concerned about other people's welfare and be engaged in helping other people. He's saying, well, when you do that, don't sacrifice your own welfare in the process. And now, when the Buddha says that, you have to understand that he means the deepest spiritual welfare that you can have. What's the deepest welfare? What's the deepest treasure? What's the deepest well-being that your psyche can have? For the Buddha, that is awakening, to become really deeply free, to have the kind of experience of freedom, of peace, of love that comes from deep spiritual practice. Now, why would he say don't sacrifice that for other people's welfare? One reason is given by an analogy that appears in the ancient texts. If there's a group of people who are stuck in quicksand or in the mud, and they're trying to get out of the quicksand, and they're trying to pull each other out, it doesn't work, because if I try to pull you out from the quicksand, then I'll sink further down. Then you try to pull me out, then you'll sink further down. It just doesn't work in quicksand. But if one person gets up on dry land, then that person can reach down and pull everyone else out. So that analogy is used then in classic Buddhism to understand spiritual life. That if we're all lost in delusion, lost in the world of desire and hate, then we're not on dry land. We don't have a sense of where our stability is, our balance is, or our freedom is, so that we can offer the greatest help for other people. So don't sacrifice your deepest welfare for the welfare of others, no matter how great their welfare might be. Because then you can't really do that work of really helping someone in the deepest way as possible. And one other way of understanding it is a way that you've all heard of, I believe, lots of people who get engaged in the world for good intentions. And maybe it's a very good cause they're engaged in. But the motivation by which they're doing it, or the emotional reactivity that they entangle with that activity, makes it a mixed blessing that they're doing that kind of work. Peacemakers who are filled with hate, you know, it kind of somehow doesn't quite jive. And sometimes, I mean, it was in the 60s, in the anti-war movement in the 60s, there's lots of women who report being completely discouraged by all these, peace activist men who back then were so sexist and so demeaning to the women who were involved. And how could they treat another person the way they treated us as women in the peace movement? lots of better examples than I'm giving, but I'm sure you can think of your own examples. So don't sacrifice your own welfare for others' welfare, no matter how great. How does that translate to people now who are upset about current affairs? It's very easy to be angry with current affairs. It's very easy to hate people out of what's happening in the world today. Don't sacrifice your own welfare. Do the inner spiritual work that finds your own balance, where you don't sacrifice your own well-being by becoming hateful, by becoming angry, by getting lost in your fear. In Buddhism, we put a very high value on doing the very careful and sometimes very difficult work, disciplined work, of paying attention to our own hearts. So the well-being of our own hearts, the peace and the love in our own hearts, is not sacrificed because we're swept up in hate and anger and fear. It doesn't mean that we're not critical of what happens in the world, but the criticism doesn't have to translate to sacrificing the well-being of our own heart. And in fact, perhaps from a Buddhist point of view, there's an unfortunate paradox or irony in that if we're opposing violence in the world and our own heart have a violent intent, even if it's not physically violent, we're still filled with hate and we talk in ways which are not very respectful of other people, then, you know, we're actually doing the very thing that we're criticizing other people of doing also. So you've heard that kind of argument before, I'm sure. So don't sacrifice your own welfare for the welfare of others, no matter how great. And when you and in doing that and taking care of yourself, then please be helpful to other people. I've had to learn this, for example, in my own family, being now having a larger family, and a family of two adults and two kids. And one of my Achilles heels is my sense of responsibility. So it just, it just wears you down if you have a neurotic attachment to being responsible, right? Especially when you... and also kind of part of that is all kind of... I kind of sometimes will give myself to others to a fault. And what I've learned in my family life is that, especially with young children, is that they're kind of like hungry ghosts. it turns out that with reasonable people, it seems you can, give, and there's an end to giving. But with children, it seems like there's never any end to how much, at least our child, wants attention. So this idea of, giving, that at some point, it just didn't work. And I realized that that my own welfare was not being attended to well enough. But what was very clear was, as my own welfare was not being attended to well enough, then I wasn't actually able to be helpful to my family in the way that I really felt was appropriate also. And then when I learned to pull back and take care of myself better, or create the limits that needed to be made, it turns out that was helpful for my son. But it was also helpful because then I'm available in higher quality way of responding to my family, being with my family. And so the whole system works much better. When I was the kitchen manager at the monastery, it was a little bit different dynamic there, where it's not quite logical how this, but you forgive me for this. I'll tell you a story. And I was a kitchen manager, and I could do everything better than everybody else in the kitchen. I'd been there longer. I knew how I was, and I could I was really good at multitasking, and I could make the soup and do three other things. And the amount of time it took me to explain to another person how to make the soup, which was very inefficient because I might as well just do it, right? And the three other things. And so I would, run around and do all these things, and I was supposed to supervise everybody else also in their jobs. And it took me about 4 months to learn that the whole kitchen, it was a crew of maybe nine people or so, maybe sometimes 12, 16 people in the kitchen, depending on what was going on in the monastery. It was a big crew. It took me about 4 months until about the end of my shift as the kitchen manager to learn that the whole kitchen ran a lot better, everybody was a lot happier, if as the kitchen manager, I didn't do any work at all. And rather, I went around and just made sure everybody else was happy. Do you need something? Can I go get the carrots from the walk-in? Can I, wash these dishes for you and make it a little bit easier? And I just made sure everybody else's job went smoothly. And that was a hard lesson for me to learn. So how do we take care of ourselves? How do we take care of others by taking care of ourselves? And how do we take care of ourselves by taking care of others? So that's the question the Buddha wants to answer next in the story. And how is it that by protecting oneself, one protects others? And then he explains, by the pursuit, development, and cultivation of the four foundations of mindfulness. So that we've talked about already. And then how is it that by protecting others, one protects oneself? By patience, harmlessness, loving kindness, and compassion. It is in such a way that by protecting others, one protects oneself. What's interesting about patience, happiness, loving kindness, and compassion is that these are all internal movements within ourselves. They're emotional or responses, motivational responses, intentions we have within ourselves towards others. It's not practical things. He doesn't say you should protect others by hiring bodyguards for them, or you should protect others by insisting that they wear seatbelts. I mean, you should do those things, I suppose, with seatbelts at least. But he's saying the way you protect others is through something that arises within yourself. So it's some finding a balance in yourself, finding your own capacity is very important here. And you don't find in a healthy way the movement for harmlessness, patience, loving kindness, compassion through being centered, balanced, at peace with yourself in some way, defining this place here. Otherwise, if you're not balanced or centered on yourself, it's too easy for the compassion we have to be a fragile compassion, to be a should that we should do, to be a forced ideal that we put ourselves into, as opposed to something that arises naturally out of, you know, the goodness of our own hearts. So, in finding these things, harmlessness, patience, loving kindness, and compassion within ourselves, and then living that way, extending that to others, we're protecting them at least from ourselves, right? And how many times in your life, you know, looking back, do you wish you would have protected someone from yourself? It's not to be, you know, it's pretty good. And then in protecting others that way, you also protect yourself. If you extend these good qualities to other people will treat you better. Chances are. The tendency in this world is that if you meet other people with love, with patience, with non-harming, that they'll treat you in return in a different way. There's no guarantee. But it seems like that's the kind of way in which society tends to operate the most. Not just society, but I suspect whole nations. If whole nations practice compassion, loving kindness, non-harming, and what did I say? Oh, any of those four, that patience, probably the whole world will respond in a different way. So are there ways that you sacrifice yourself for the well-being of others, which is not so healthy? Are there ways in which you can take care of yourself that it's actually helpful for helping you take care of other people? That's really the question here. And then the suggestion from the Buddha, at least, is that the practice of mindfulness is one of the key ways of finding this way of being balanced. Only you can find your own balance that's healthy and reliable. And so if only you can do it, you have to have at least have the self-awareness to notice when you're imbalanced and notice when you're balanced, if you're going to take responsibility for that. And the last thing I'll say is that a lesson I've also learned from my family life is that the family life changed how much freedom I had to do whatever I wanted to do with children, you know, sleeping through the night and other things. And so it required a lot of letting go. And letting go is a very central element of Buddhist spirituality. The deepest developments of Buddhist spirituality come from very deep letting go. Renunciation is a high ideal in the Buddhist tradition. Certain kinds of renunciation, letting go. What I learned is that letting go only works if letting go brings joy. And there were times when I let go and there was resentment, or I got grumpy, or whatever. And what I came to understand is that then my task of mindfulness, the way to protect myself and to protect others, was to bring the attention in and explore why is it joy wasn't born within me when I let go. Maybe it was inappropriate to let go of those things. I shouldn't have let go in the first place. Or perhaps there was something I was still holding on to of a different form, different nature. What is it I really had to let go of in my heart, so that in letting go of X, I could find joy and happiness and peace? Part of what I've learned through meditation practice is that through letting go in a deep way, it's as if in the core of our psyche, a peace and a happiness that requires nothing. So if I'm always needing something or wanting something or demanding something for my life, I haven't, you know, then it tends to blind me or mask that deep inner at-homeness. So because of that lesson, the idea of, oh, letting go only works if there's joy in it. Can I find the joy that's possible? Because I know it's possible to find joy with needing nothing. Something like that. So all this is supposed to be, you know, trying to exemplify this idea of protecting self, we protect others, and protecting others, we protect ourselves. So maybe that's enough for today. And do you have any comments or questions? Yes?
I was, when you were talking about examples of this idea of protecting others, not protecting yourself, and how it's sort of contrary to Western psyche, an example that came to my mind was something that it seemed odd the first time I had seen it. It seems to be odd that other people, as when you're traveling in an airplane, would say, always put the oxygen mask on yourself first. And like, don't put it on the small children first. And it's kind of obvious why, but it always strikes you as like.
Great. So you hear that? The example of being on the airplane. People outside couldn't hear in the outer room. So this example of the airplanes, it first seemed odd, but then it became obvious to see that the instructions are put the oxygen mask on yourself before doing the children. You know, you're supposed to do the children first, right? Children, yeah.
There's a whole idea of looking at your own needs first. Is very common in psychology. It's a big advice they give couples who do have children, because they forget about their marriage, and the marriage will affect the child. But even in the Muslim and the Jewish religion, you know, there's a commandment about, or you're told to give a certain percentage of your money away. And the scholars in both religions point out that it's a percentage. You shouldn't give everything away. If you gave everything away, then you couldn't keep on giving. So just keep enough for yourself to have a happy, comfortable lifestyle, and you can continue to give. So it's, I think it's a universal, wise thing to do.
Yes, please.
Listening to these examples, I think of the fruit tree, which only gives fruit after the roots have received the nutrients that it needs to produce the fruit. Very difficult to find a fruit tree with no roots. Very.
Great, lovely. Yes, in the back.
The idea of setting an example for somebody else, because when you try to set an example, you kind of demand something of somebody. And I think in my life, through my youth and the way I was raised, you kind of set examples of doing what is good and thinking of others, but in doing that, you kind of expect somebody else to do the same thing. And I have trouble letting go.
Great.
Because if I set an example, I just feel that other people should respond. Yeah.
Great. That's a great point. Yeah, it's very dangerous to this idea of setting an example with the expectation that example will, you know, other people will follow it. And it's a little bit maybe presumptuous, too, to kind of expect someone. But there's example and there's modeling. So a lot of people give us the advice as parents. They say the way you teach children values is you model behavior. It works better than so I think modeling is one way. But I think the idea of protecting oneself, taking care of oneself, there's other ways in which that benefit, other ways that benefits people besides being an example. So if you take care of yourself, then perhaps you can stay calm in a situation that otherwise you would have been agitated. And by being calm, you can see what the right thing is to do to help the other person in a desperate situation. What comes to mind right now is not a very good example, but when I was living at Green Gulch, there was a little problem with once when I was there of some little fires got started. We didn't know how. And one day I was coming out of the barn, and I think it was a dark, and I saw a little spark of flame up on the hillside. And it required, you know, because of this history of little fires, that doing something right away. And so I did something right away, and people responded accordingly. It turned out someone was just, some very responsible person was just someplace up there having a cigarette or something, but it wasn't anything dangerous. But later I was told by people that I had gotten too agitated. I mean, the way that hadn't been useful for the whole situation. I got very excited. Oh, we got to do something. And it helps. It would have helped everyone if I had stayed calmer in that situation. So it's not just simply a matter of providing an example. It's also in protecting oneself, but it's also then responsive to the situation around one in wiser ways. Is that okay? So I saw your hand. Yes. Great, great example. You know, I think that there's so much diversity and so many different ways in which people develop and need to develop and ways in which people get imbalanced. In the story here, the Buddha comments on the acrobats, and he says, in that situation, the assistant was right. That the way we protect each other, the way I protect you is by protecting myself, by finding my own balance. And he said, it's very particular, he says, in that particular situation, that there's method there. And I certainly have met people who, are known people in my capacity as a teacher, who I felt were so lost to themselves and so something, like maybe this person in the movie, that I would encourage them to go out and find work or do something that takes them, that where they're actually giving involved in other people, because that's where the important personal development will happen, and they'll find joy and connectedness and many of the things that need to be found. So I wouldn't want to say there's only one way, I believe this is a very important principle. And even this English actor, if he found in this movie even though he might become happy through helping other people, it's a principle that once he finds balance that way, he probably still needs to take care of himself in the way that we've been talking about today. So I love that example, and I think it's very profound for some people to find themselves through service. In the outer room, yeah.
I think another illustration of what you've been talking about is you every so often encounter people who get into a martyrdom role, and they give their all for whatever, if it's a job or whatever, domestic situation. Eventually, it makes people around you very uncomfortable, because probably they never requested that this person get into a anecdote type of thing, and it's kind of an example of how toxic things can get when you don't take care of your own basic needs.
It can be, yes. Yeah, yeah. Yes.
It's kind of been said by you and people speaking, especially the example of the tree and the roots, but I grew up in a very extreme fundamentalist Christian background. I believe very strongly in the idea of being crucified with Christ. So that and even as a young teenager, I was very devout about that. And I, for myself, I found that that had to completely change because I found at a very deep level that I could not give away what I didn't have in the first place. And it also kind of implied that there was a self, almost a finite self that could be, you know, that could be gone. And there wasn't a lot of responsibility for personal discovery in that. It was more about aiming for something outside of yourself. And the transition that I've gone through as an adult and why like, things that you teach really are meaningful to me is it kind of turns out on its ear and it says, I'm an infinite being. And if I can take responsibility for who I am in my all these infinities and allow those to live, I have even more to give than if this undeveloped person self that I thought had to die. That's it completely changes the parameters for living. And not only does it free me as an individual to continue a deep, deep exploration and the taking of responsibility and discovery, but it also there are those moments when I have the choice to give where it really does push. It's, you know, can I give this? And there isn't that panic that I might lose myself because I'm doing all this work of discovering a greater self. And so the giving then is truly genuine. And it's what you talk about, there's a joy in it. There isn't the resentment or the terror of the loss of self. It's just, I can lose myself for a moment. I can lose myself for 5 minutes. It's okay. There's a greater self.
Beautiful. It's beautifully said. Thank you. Bonnie.
In a slightly different twist, I had an example come up for me last week. I hadn't been here in a while, and I was really looking forward to coming here last Sunday. And my husband's been traveling a lot, and I thought, I have to do this for myself. So I made that understood to my children. One of them was had a sleepover, and I said, you'll need to get yourself home. I'm going to be gone. I won't be home until 11:30. So I was literally leaving at 9 o'clock. Phone rang. And it was my daughter at a sleepover saying, crying hysterically, that she found a tick on herself in this pretty shame-based, to her, a very shameful place, and she was hysterical. And I just ran over and got her. And at other times in my life, I would have felt very resentful. She came home, and I just was there for her. And she was just, maybe an exaggerated, but for her, it was just a horrible situation. And what I noticed was I felt such joy that I had the opportunity to be there for her because teenagers don't want you near them. And this has been a while since she wanted me close by. And then she apologized because she knew it. She kind of the timing ruined my being able to come here, and I just completely let that go. It didn't matter. So, and then when I thought more about it, well, I do give to myself in other ways, but this is such an important role that when something like that comes up, you let other things fall off. And so, what I was left with was the joy.
Beautiful. Thank you. So, a last one.
Golden rule in the relationship between, that's what came up for me in the question about the relationship.
Don't do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit more?
So I'm just exploring. That's what came up for me, and I would like to explore the relationship between.
Yeah, nothing comes to mind to me if that's what you're hoping for me to comment on, but yeah. Does anybody have any comments on the golden rule and talk? Yes?
I feel like I'm putting a creaking bubble. I feel like we're being somewhat self-congratulatory this morning.
Say it again. Look.
I think that I'm feeling as a member of the Sangha, we're being a bit self-congratulatory.
Uh-huh.
That you alluded in what you said to another level, which is more of a social level, and suggested that there was a very strong strand built into the culture of the United States of altruism. And I gently really question that, particularly in this entrepreneurial valley, in which what you're saying is easily distorted into take care of myself and it will trickle down to others. And that in many ways the country was founded on a freedom from, not a freedom from things, so that you are a rugged individualist to do what you want. And it's translated as a single example as a country. Into being the richest country in the world and the only Western democracy that doesn't look at healthcare as a right for everybody. And that's justified in all kinds of ways. And you very gently alluded to how we perhaps are being perceived by the rest of the world today. And I took that to be the inverse of a compassionate, generous country. That is not how we are perceived in the rest of the world. We have the most power of any country in the history of the world, and we have almost no influence in the world. So translating what you say, which is so clear on an interpersonal level or on a family level, to a broader societal level, I think is an absolute challenge to all of us. And that, I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh always reminds us that we are our government. And I think that there's a real disconnect between what we're feeling about our personal lives and interactions in this room and how that's perceived by the rest of the world.
Beautiful. I think it's great what you said. And I think that the... I believe anybody who's sensitive to the conditions in the world, whether it's to family or local society or the wider society, will understand the tremendous, almost imperative, for letting go, or for at least for the, you know, and then the task is how to let go in such a way that it enriches us in the way that, because Karen was talking about how do we let go and, you know, live a life that is more in harmony with the needs of the wider society in the way that also provides joy for us rather than resentment and all that. That's really the task. And I think I'm fond of the fact that the Four Noble Truths, which are really the central teachings of the Buddha, have no pronouns connected to them. So it doesn't say, you know, I suffer, you know, or you suffer. It's just just suffering exists. And how I take that is that we should be sensitive to suffering in all directions, not just inside of here. And there's a certain kind of suffering that arises if our attention is fixated just on ourselves. That self is a kind of suffering and pain. And that once we kind of lose the pronouns, then we become sensitive to the suffering in all directions. If we're only aware of the suffering externally and not here, then it's imbalanced also. So I like to think of Buddhism encouraging people to be not self-centered, not other-centered, but what I call, I think other people have called this too, but situation-centered. And why I like situation-centered is it implies you're connected to the whole situation. But the center of the situation, for any individual person, guess where it is? It's right here. So your awareness starts here, and then it radiates out from here with no boundaries, inside or out. And then I think one of the points you're making is that, that I heard through you, is this, that the world, especially in a country like ours, in a society like ours, that often we're required to let go if we're sensitive to need around us. Like Bonnie, who had to let go because of her teenage daughter. And that's what was required at that time. And different people have different evaluations of where the boundaries of that letting go will be. But I think it's really essential that we tune in to the world around us and then learn how to live in ways that are compassionate and kind. And if it requires letting go, that we learn to do that in a way that's healthy. So my hope, and as you leave this talk today, is that you don't leave with answers, but prime to think more deeply about all these kind of topics. And so may you all think about this for the week. Thank you.